Hello, and welcome to another podcast by the Oxford Society for International Development. My name is Jemima Sinclair, the Asia and Pacific Events Officer for this term, and this is the second of a two-part series about internet censorship and regulation in China, following Zealand's brilliant first episode. Check it out on oxford.org if you haven't yet. Through this podcast, we aim to explore how and why internet censorship is used in China and its repercussions both in the country and globally. We have a fantastic speaker joining us, Professor Zhongbin Han from the Department of International Affairs at the University of Georgia. His book, Contesting Cyberspace in China, Online Expression and Authoritarianism Resilience, gives us a fascinating insight into the world of internet censorship in Chinese cyberspace. I hope you find what he has to say as enriching as we did. To begin with, I wanted to ask Professor Han about how and why internet censorship is used in China.
Okay, thank you very much for having me in the first place. And you started with a very big question. Censorship is just part of a bigger apparatus or mechanism of information control and management in China, and I believe elsewhere as well. So even though much of my own work is about censorship, but my work is also beyond censorship. So I hope that the audience will get that. And even if we narrow it down to censorship, we have to understand that censorship is a system that's highly sophisticated, multifaceted, dynamic, and fast evolving. And if you're talking about what censorship is like, there are so many things we can talk about. Again, the first thing is about the components of the censorship system. It's a comprehensive system that covers the legal aspect, administrative aspect, technological aspect, even the social aspect, right? If you are thinking about the legal aspect, there are so many laws and regulations, both at the national level and at the local level, regulating what type of content is acceptable, what is not. And there are implicit institutions governing the process. It's like not everything is stipulated clearly in the law. And if you look at the type of censorship, there's the self-censorship, kind of peer censorship, and also platform censorship in addition to government censorship, right? All those kind of things are happening driven by multiple motives of multiple actors. A lot of the times the motivation is political, for sure, but also we have to understand business is driving censorship. So that's kind of the complicated things we can talk about. And also, like, you know, the administrative one, if you look at who is actually enforcing censorship, at very beginning, it's like, you know, the government wasn't really sure what the internet means. So it was mostly like they were focusing on the security of the network infrastructure. They were not looking at the content. But as people started to express online, they started to realize that regulating and controlling content is important. And initially it was Ministry of Public Security. And then more and more sectors of the government get involved, and government, and actually the state is probably a more accurate term because it's not just the government, but also the party, right? And then we see two apparatus emerge in this process. It's like the State Council Information Office and also the Propaganda Department, Central Propaganda Department. Those two becoming more prominent in orchestrating and also coordinating everything, even though the whole process is pretty fragmented because it's like local governments can fit in, business can fit in, individual ministries, sectors can fit in, but generally the process is coordinated at the top by the State Information, State Council Information Office and Central Propaganda Department. But then President Xi Jinping come into power, you also see the cyber administration of China becoming the kind of the overarching institution or organization that oversees censorship. But even there, if you look at the kind of implementation of specific censorship, you can still see different agencies. So overall, the whole thing is very complicated with so many kind of actors, factors, motives, and the mechanism is all different because, I mean, how each of those agencies interact with each other and interact with the people. We can look at it from the user's perspective, right? If you are trying to publish something online, What's the process? Initially, it was easy. You can just register an account with an email, or sometimes, you know, it's even easier. Later, they started to ask for real name registration. There was resistance, but ultimately, it's kind of there now because most of the accounts you set up online require you to provide some sort of real name registration, either, say, a phone number. In the late 1990s, early 2000s, you can buy SIM cards on street, right? Vendors. From there, you don't have to provide any ID information there. You can buy in bulk. Now it's becoming almost impossible. You have to provide your real name for a mobile phone number. And then if you want to register an account on some online platform, you have to provide that number, right? So that's basically indirect real name registration. That's almost there. Is there a leeway for people? Yes, but for most people, no, right? And then you have to have your account created, and then you started to put in something. And most major platforms, you go through a automatic filtering system. They mostly detect keywords. So will there be something triggering the censorship system or not, right? If not, you go through. If yes, there are a number of things can happen. One, you got rejected, you know, and you try to figure out why, and then you actually remove some of the blocked words and then go through again, okay? Sometimes the system is tricky. It don't tell you what happened. It seems that everything went through, but only you yourself can see it. Nobody else can see it. So even after you get things through, it's not the time to say hooray, because you know the government may come back and decide to censor some stuff that's already published like years ago. Censorship changes to the circumstance, as we will probably discuss later in terms of adjusting censorship over time. So generally, for most people, that's kind of the process and the type of censorship you might encounter if you try to publish anything. If you don't want to publish anything, then the problem is really you try to access certain information, you got blocked, right? Great firewall blocks you from certain things. And there was a time when I was here in the United States when I tried to search some sensitive words using the Baidu search engine, and my IP address got kind of blocked for like first a few minutes. Then I tried again, the block time extended to an hour or so. I heard that if you repeatedly try, the block time would actually kind of go up. So it's the Great Firewall is actually kind of, you know, going in both directions, not just kind of for people accessing information from outside China, but also for people like accessing information from inside China, but to kind of foreign websites. A lot of the times you search, you find some information, you click on it, it shows 404 or some other code. Basically, it's gone.
We then move to talking about what strategies the government uses for its censorship, what are its motivations, and what actually gets censored in China.
So as far as the strategies are concerned, there are so many studies on internet censorship strategy, and we, the scholars, don't really agree on each other in a lot of the things. So you've asked about what type of stuff kind of got censored, right? So there's definitely selective censorship. We have been trying to explore why the government wants to censor, how censorship's done, why certain types of censorship, why certain type of content is censored, not others. Why did censorship at this time, not at another time, right? So all those questions we're trying to explore. We don't really have perfect answers. I will talk about why, but we do have some findings there. So in terms of what motivates censorship overall, I think the studies can be roughly divided into two camps that are pointing at different directions. The first group is what I call strategic censorship. The term is borrowed from Peter Lawrence's article, Strategic Censorship in China, which is implicitly or explicitly assumes that the Chinese state government has a clear strategy, censorship strategy, that guides it in terms of what to censor, when to censor, how to censor, etc., right? Among these studies, the most well-known probably study is by Kingpin Roberts. They have two articles, one I think in APSR, the other in Science. So their methodological approach is very sound. And also actually Roberts, Molly Roberts has a book on censored, which deserves a lot of attention here as well. So they find, say, basically the government wants to censor collective action related content more so than general criticism towards the government. So they've been actually kind of pulling data from thousands of platforms, detecting what type of content has been removed and what has been, you know, preserved, and they coded the type of content that has been censored, and then, you know, put them into different categories, and they analyze what type of stuff got censored and what not. So for instance, Peter Lawrenson's article, Strategic Censorship, he constructs a model arguing that the central government, the authoritarian regime can benefit from kind of selectively tolerating certain type of information. Basically, it would be better for the central government to tolerate criticism over local governments, local officials, but not critical reporting on top leadership, because that helps preserving the regime's legitimacy and also helps to discipline local officials, which is actually good for an authoritarian regime. And there are studies building on this, saying that the censorship, strategic censorship, can be dynamic. Censors may adjust the acceptable level or boundary of expression on a number of factors to achieve effective censorship. My own study is included there, but before that, a number of studies have shown how the state may fine-tune control over specific online crises or during important political events, such as, you know, the 2012 scandal surrounding former Politburo member and Chongqing party chief Bo Xilai. The authors find that the government was not only differentiating between critical and supportive expressions, but also adjusting the level of censorship over time. So it's very kind of detailed fine-tuning happening there. I mentioned my own work. I myself have a forthcoming co-authored article on this, how the government adjusts the scale of censorship across time. So we find basically consistent evidence of the government kind of enhancing the overall level of censorship during important political ceremonies, such as the party congress meeting time or major anniversaries of, say, the People's Republic of China. Our finding basically indicates that it's not just like the government is patrolling, you know, the highway. Anybody speeding will get kind of, you know, ticketed. We find that the government might adjust the speed limit, that basically putting a lot of acceptable expression on day one into the unacceptable zones. In terms of motivation behind, is it driven by, like, say, concern about threats towards stability or legitimacy? Probably yes. For instance, studies show that important political ceremonies sometimes can be the political opportunity for, you know, collective mobilization. People know that's the time to mobilize. And also in terms of legitimacy matters, right? It's like if you have negative information, negative coverage during an important ceremony, that basically signals a bigger challenge towards the legitimacy. We also have a third argument. We were not able to really substantiate that argument with like solid firsthand empirical data, like experiment. We hope to do that in the future, but we believe that there might be like, you know, the government simply wants to save face, simply doesn't want to look bad in front of the public. It's like, we're in a happy mood right now. Nobody ruins that party mood kind of thing. Because a lot of the times, right, suppressing already tolerated kind of expression during so a certain time is not necessarily the best idea. It's like people were complaining before and now people continue to complain about that. What's wrong with that? unless they are really becoming, right, more violent, right, or escalating or going to street. If they are complaining online can be venting, can be a good thing, right? Especially during the high pressure time. And also, it's like if you're really concerned about legitimacy, it's like, why don't you just keep that tight control constant? Why it's like, say 30 days after the 60th anniversary of PRC, the restriction is gone. Sometimes I suspect it's the local government or the, say, propaganda department official. They just wanted to, now president is kind of enjoying the party. Let's just kind of, cool things down at this moment. The party is over. Okay, everything goes back to normal, right? So that's what we suspect. We hope in the future we can substantiate that argument with more solid evidence. But that's one camp. So people basically think there is a strategy, even though we are not quite clear what really motivates that. The second group of studies do not see censorships as being driven by at least one grand strategy. So I would put myself more comfortably here in this camp. The censorship regime is composed of many different actors who are motivated in different ways and get involved in censorship to different degrees, right? For instance, we talk about local government. They want to censor local scandals badly, but the central government may be less incentivized to do so, according to like Peter Lawrence at least, right? My own field work also shows that business interests sometimes may influence censorship in different ways. Multinational corporations, they may be maintaining good relationship with the propaganda department. Once they have a PR kind of fiasco, they can resort to censorship to help them. I'm not sure, to what extent centralization has happened, but we do see the trend. I don't believe, for instance, now that the censorship is highly centralized, everything comes from the Cyber Administration of China. I don't think that's the case. But indeed, it's much more coordinated and centralized than at the very beginning. We see a lot of evidence of local governments getting involved. There are reports about, say, one local government calling another local government, asking them to delete stuff for them, and they cover each other up. We coded some of the leaked official censorship directive and found a bunch of those directives are seemingly just dealing with local issues. So we suppose it's this local government. We see like those censorship directives that are targeting specific enterprises. It's like there's a scandal about a local enterprise, and then the government issued a directive, censorship directive, saying remove everything related to that. Everything's happening in a very complicated, multi-layer, dynamic, interactive process. And the state is, especially central government, probably is dominating, but they are not really kind of doing everything by themselves in the first place. Second of all, it's not just all about them. We're mostly guessing the state's motive. And my observation suggests that maybe they're just trying to keep like party mode going on at certain time. And we also find, like, say, the government censors a lot of porn stuff, right? It's like, if you're really concerned about, just concerned about stability, why would you censor online porn? I would encourage it, right? It's like, it seems if we look at that, we probably guess the government also have a moral, has the moral obligation. It actually makes sense considering the communist nature of the regime, right? China was very proud that it is eliminated, say, gambling and prostitution at the very beginning of, of the regime, right? So that's kind of a moral obligation in a sense to the society. So the government does that.
We then started to talk about how successful the government is in implementing these strategies, and also what people think of them.
In terms of censorship effectiveness, again, we have different ways of looking at it. First, to figure out what is the goal of the government. Do they achieve the goal? Right? If they achieve the goal, it can be effective. If not, it's not effective. But of course, there's another element, as you suggested. It's like, how do people perceive it? Right? What is actually the kind of, implications, not necessarily effectiveness, but implications of censorship? especially from citizens and the public, and even the international perspective, right? You know, how does the entire international community see this? Do they wish to achieve perfect censorship, or they just want to achieve efficient censorship? Increasingly, I believe the latter is the case, partially because it's impossible to really achieve perfect censorship. Second, it might not be desirable for the government to really achieve 100%. It's like for cost-benefit analysis, like invest huge amount of resources. Censorship costs resources, right? And human power and all those kind of things you invest, you don't necessarily kind of, you know, get the output that you want. Second, it's like as Peter Lawrence's work and my own work suggests that a certain level of criticism can be helpful for the regime. So in that regard, if we think that the government is just trying to achieve effective censorship, I think the Chinese government has achieved the goal. But having said that, we do see the level of overall censorship fluctuates over time. So we just talk about, say, important anniversaries. And Peter Lawrence suggests that, say, if there is kind of a rise in social tensions, that might be a result, kind of that might lead to enhanced overall control. And we can't neglect, say, the different leadership style of individual top leaders, right? So some leaders might want to more tightly control the internet than others. So all those might be factors over time. But overall, I think so far, the government have maintained effective censorship. How do people view it?
Firstly, we discussed how tech-savvy people can always evade censorship somehow. And then we talked about the fact that when something is censored, people are far more likely to respond to it and be angered by the censorship than if it had never been censored in the first place.
And we do see a number of things in which actually the public is so overwhelming that the state is not really doing too much. So for instance, you probably have heard about Dr. Li Wenliang, right? He has a Weibo account and there are millions of comments after he passed away due to COVID. It was at least, I mean, I haven't checked it lately, but for a very long time, we don't see actually the government to really boldly, right, heavily censor the kind of, you know, his microblog or Weibo account too much there. And also, lately, China just kind of said, we are allowing a surchild, right, policy. So it's like, I think it was Gongqing Tuan Zhongyang, the Chinese Communist Youth League microblog account, Weibo account, they posted something online. And then you can see a huge wave of criticism. People call that fanche, it's like, you know, a car wreck, you know, a scene. It's like, you know, the party tries to do certain things, but you see public outcry against certain policy. It's like occasionally you do see that before censorship comes, people still have the opportunity to kind of express and spread the word and doing all sorts of things. So if you're looking at that, there's always an opportunity. Frankly speaking, my own book suggests that sometimes the censorship, which is echoing Robert and his co-author, it's like sometimes overly rigid censorship really makes people to hate this the censorship system, or actually also become more critical towards the regime in general. So I personally argue that, say, sometimes losing censorship might work better for the regime.
I then asked whether he thought that applied to censorship generally, whether there is a hatred for censorship overall.
I would say this, overall, censorship in itself is not an issue for the party or the people in China. So there are multiple reasons, right? It's like a lot of people, especially liberal intellectuals, don't want any type of censorship. But traditional culture, right, it's there. Chinese people, most of the time, have a very different type of mindset. A lot of those liberal ideas are coming from the West. They have a long way, actually, kind of, you know, to walk in China. We have to kind of bear that in mind. Most people think that by default, there should be some level of censorship. Indeed, actually, it's like a number of research survey research asking people, do you think the government should manage the internet, online content, and things like that, majority of people say yes. And there's an interesting related study about the social credit system in China, which is kind of not really censorship, but related. I want to bring it's a New Media and Society article. It was a survey among people about, you know, your perception towards social credit system. So first of all, majority of people, 70%, 60% plus people think it's okay to have, we need a social credit system. And there are people like, when people are asked, it's like, if there's a social credit system, do you think the central government, local government, or, you know, some business should run it? Most people say the central government should run it, right? It's like the mindset is very different of the Chinese people compared to people, you know, elsewhere. I mean, I'm actually wondering, say, if you ask the question about, do you think a certain level of censorship is justified in a different society? I mean, I bet there are people, even in the United States, say yes, right? It's like, the matter is really kind of how big that percentage is. But in general, in China, there's a pretty high percentage of people say, first of all, censorship is necessary. Why? It has something to do with how people actually kind of, you know, experience online and what people worry about, right? So parents would say, I don't want porn or violent stuff, kind of my kids to be exposed to that type of stuff. So yes, somebody censored that, right? Not mentioning that the Chinese people generally trust the government to do the job. One of the most recent studies by like a group of Harvard scholars, the Ash Center, they find that it's not only that the Chinese public trust in this government, especially the central government, is high. It's like 80, 90%, right? Throughout the time, but also the trust is actually increasing. If people are worrying about certain stuff online that should be removed, and who should do it? The government, right? That's a perfect logic. Like how the government justifies censorship, right? So this related to like saying the government censors only political content or censors both political content and some kind of, you know, porn and other stuff. Does it matter? So that's related to the strategy. I've observed something like this. I don't know whether it's by design or not, but generally the Chinese government sends both political and non-political stuff. That might be helping the government to justify censorship. We just mentioned that, say, a lot of parents want the government to censor porn, violent stuff from the internet, and the government does that. So they support the government even when they are censoring political stuff. That's the logic. And frankly speaking, a lot of people directly support censoring political stuff. That has something to do with my other article, The Voluntary 50% Army. There are people generally pro-government, and they don't like, say, Western values because of their nationalistic motivation or other motivations, or they don't like the pro-liberal intellectuals for multiple reasons. And the government now further justifies censorship by, look, Twitter just suspended President Trump's account, right? Isn't they are doing censorship? Or like, say, Facebook just banned thousands of, you know, accounts. And it's not just kind of the government justifying censorship using those by widely reporting those stuff, but also it's like directly related to a lot of Chinese people's overseas experience. I have a paper I'm working on, so I can share with you at this moment. My study shows that overseas experiences might not necessarily make people more supporting more kind of liberal democratic value or against censorship. Not necessarily. I'm watching, say, YouTube a lot, especially certain types of YouTube kind of vloggers, because this is part of my research, probably future research. And I found that a lot of people who claim they're from China and they are sharing their experiences of being silenced on, say, YouTube. I don't know where that kind of, you know, censorship comes from. Is it YouTube or is it some of the channel or vloggers themselves kind of censoring their own channels? I don't know why they did it, whether that's because of something, they say something extremely horrible, right? Advocating terrorism, or just they are defending China as they claim to be, right? Those kind of experiences, when they share with other Chinese netizens somewhere else, and people would start to develop an impression. It's like censorship is everywhere in every society, under every political system. So why do you complain? If actually the US is able to censor the internet in the name of democracy and freedom, why can't China censorship stuff based on communism? It's like that. That's the logic there. So, I mean, I think the Chinese government don't really have a tough time justifying censorship. It just have a tough time justifying censorship of specific topics. For instance, if they did censor Dr. Li Wenliang, right, they're in trouble because people are going to question why. But if they say we're censoring, say, those unpopular political dissidents, nobody cares. Most people don't care, actually. Or if not, many people say applaud. Yeah, that's a good idea. Censor like Wang Dan, right? Censor Cai Ning, censor Wu Keish, or censor those, you know, Tibetan or Uyghur independent or separatists, right? Do that. Right? It's like, we fully support that. That might be the mindset of a lot of people. I see what is happening in Chinese cyberspace as a discourse competition, right? Censorship is just part of the game. When the Chinese netizens are defending the party, censorship is not an issue at all. It's even sometimes they welcome that. And second of all, criticism towards Chinese government might not actually work, may backlash.
I then asked Dr. Han about censorship that comes from businesses and how that plays into government censorship.
So there are different types of business censorship. We just mentioned one type. It's like when the businesses work through the government. So if the businesses want to work through the government, they have to have some influence, no matter if, kind of, you know, out of what reason, whether it's because of ties or because of its strategic importance for the government, because government want to pursue economic growth. So if you're a huge investor, right, the government want to pave the way for you, right? So they wanted to help you. If you ask them for a favor to remove some kind of critical information, they might do it, right? It might be like, you know, working at different levels. Some multinational corporations might be having good ties with the central propaganda department. Some local influential enterprises might be having good relationship with local governments, so who can chip in, help them in one way or the other. I think we have evidence from both. At the same time, business is also doing another form of censorship all the time. It's like, you know, they directly work with the platforms. It's part of PR. It's like, why do they have to go through an intermediary actor, the state, which is costly, if you can work with the platforms? And I don't think that's actually kind of a new game just to the internet, because you might have heard about, say, journalists taking bribes from, you know, the firms or businesses and retracting a critical news report. Or sometimes they blackmail firms and say, if you don't bribe me, I'm going to publish a critical report on you. The same or similar mechanism might be working online, of course, somewhat like, you know, Amazon review, right? Sometimes critical reviews got either removed directly or sometimes suppressed. It's not reflected in the kind of the star rates. It's a gray area. And there's also this kind of water army thing, which is like the 50 Cent army, the astroturfing. The state is doing that. The business is doing that. There are very notorious cases of like movies buying reviews or buying negative reviews towards their competitors. It's like, you know, there's a competing movie coming up. You pay a water army company who actually kind of smash the review section, just say it's trash, so people don't go to the cinema to watch that movie.
I then wanted to know, what is
like
the
water flooding? That's actually kind of related to Molly Roberts' book. She described three mechanisms of censorship. One is like censorship out of fear. And then the second is really fraction. Fraction means making it more difficult for you to access the information you want. And the third is flooding. You know, you flood the cyberspace with the information, which is junk information to a certain extent, or the information we want, so that it crowd out the information people want to look at. So Water Army functions somewhat like flooding. So it's like there's a discussion board, they flood it.
I then asked if he thought the Water Army and the 50 Cent Army were effective ways of censoring
people. My argument
people.
Is that it's not by design. The government deployed the 50 Cent Army, maybe trying to persuade people, but the 50 Cent Army are not incentivized to really do a good job. At least initially, those people are like, you know, government officials in the first place. It's kind of state employees in one capacity or the other. And they are assigned this task for kind of, you know, defending the government or spreading government wanted information at a tiny fraction of, you know, cost. It's like 50 cents, right, per post. They don't really get too much out of this process. Why should they do a good job? By the way, they're paid based on the number of posts they make, not how effectively they persuade other people. For me, if I am one of them, I would just, you know, post enough numbers every day, quoting something, the same thing. I don't care whether people receive it or not. So in general, I argue it's not quite effective. So Kingpin robots have a different perspective. For me, I think it's very easy for any people, experienced internet user, to really differentiate the type of, you know, information 50 Cent Army post online. There are a number of traits, including never interacting with other people. And also, they are using the language code that's very similar to official language, not really kind of, we netizens have a language, right? And if you look at that, you can see that there are certain users constantly posting certain type of information all the time. And average netizen never do that, right? And also, it's like, you know, sometimes you can even find they post at a relatively, you know, stable time interval. It's like every few minutes there is a post from that guy on President Xi Jinping praising him. And if you look at the history, all his posts is about President Xi Jinping. Is anybody crazy enough to do that, right? Average citizen? Probably not, right? So that's kind of easy. So I generally argue that type of 50 Cent Army work is not effective. Having said that, there's a tricky question. Are we observing everything the 50 Cent Army is doing? I don't know, right? Has the 50 Cent Army system evolved over time? Perhaps. So, I mean, that's the part we need to do research on. But the tricky thing is that it's becoming more and more difficult to do it. It's easier when their behavior is very different from the netizens, right? When their behavior, when they evolve, become more like the netizens, it's methodologically much more difficult for us to really tell the difference. The thing is that my data and Kingpin Robot's data, and you know, the covers a time span. So that tells us at least roughly by the time 2015, the pattern remains similar. But after that, we don't really know. And there are a lot of signs suggesting that they probably are not evolving that fast. So that's related to kind of, you know, say how the Chinese government does that type of job overseas, right? Astroturfing. So there is study by a group of Oxford scholars, actually, I think, on computational kind of propaganda. So say you deploy bots to spread certain type of information on a certain type of platform like Twitter. And so the authors studied, like, you know, that type of phenomenon on Twitter, and they found that a lot of the information associated with computational propaganda are actually critical towards the Chinese government. So it's more like the dissidents or, you know, Falun Gong, or all those kind of critical towards China forces are doing that. They don't really find solid evidence of the kind of pro-Chinese government computational propaganda. Yes, the Chinese government is very powerful and resourceful, but it's like there is a huge gap between what they want things to be done and how things is done.
I wondered what he thought the impact of technological development had been on the effectiveness of
I
censorship?
think there are two things I want to talk about. The first thing is really, we hinted but never went into. The government is outsourcing a lot of the censorship monitoring and also probably PR tasks to non-government actors. The platforms are doing a very good job there. It's like it makes sense for them to really kind of improve their censorship efficiency, right? It's like it's costly. If you can automate the process, you can kind of, you know, Jingri, Toutiao, or those major platforms hire thousands of manual kind of, you know, censors or monitors, right? If you can develop an effective automatic filtering system, you can kind of, you know, save the human cost of hiring 1,000, 2,000 people, right? Why not, right? So they are trying to perfect their censorship system. And that's not just restricted to censorship, especially internet monitoring. It's actually multiple levels of government are outsourcing the kind of internet monitoring job to the companies. People's Daily Online Opinion kind of center, they have that, but there are a lot of tech firms also have that. And there are some university professors who are, I mean, people like me, we're studying online information, communication and everything like that. They might actually turn that into a product that can sell to the government. It's like, look, let's help you to monitor what's happening there. How the government actually works with, you know, the business sector in particular, but the technological sector, the kind of, you know, the people who have the technology, people who have the business interest. It's like a market, and the government can be a buyer there. And the market can provide a lot of the times more efficient and better solutions to the government to achieve the goal of censorship. So overall, in that we can see the market is growing and developing. I'm like less optimistic now than 10 years ago. Because of that, one is the market growing. And the second is technology. I always believe that there's a way out. It's like when you have a great firewall, you will have technological capacity developed to overcome or circumvent the great firewall. All sorts of censorship would have a solution from the user's perspective to circumvent it. But at the same time, we have to kind of bear in mind that the technology is more pervasive than before. Technology is penetrating deeper into our life than ever before. We have cell phone, and cell phone is a tracking device, right? Ultimately can't be turned into a tracking device. Surveillance cameras are everywhere. Before the internet age, even if there are surveillance cameras everywhere, we shouldn't worry too much because people are mobile, right? You can do something here and then flee to a different distant place and hide. Now it's becoming much, much more difficult. Surveillance cameras are all networked, and facial recognition technology can recognize you technically, right, in seconds. And they can match you with a database, which now again is networked. And I think you probably have heard about the stories of someone wanted, right, showed up at a concert with thousands of attendees, and then suddenly some most wanted people, you know, that's their idol. They showed up and they got captured. I always wanted to emphasize the difference between the capacity kind of the government have and the actual thing they do. They have the capacity. It doesn't necessarily mean they're doing it. Okay. But it's scary to think about the capacity. And frankly speaking, I teach cybersecurity a little bit and also digital media and politics here. And one thing is, I'm not just concerning about the future of China in terms of a more surveilled society, but also generally human beings as a whole, right? There are works by Harvard professor Zumbaugh on surveillance capitalism. It's not just the Chinese government that has the capacity. Other governments or other countries, at least in as a whole, might have similar capacity. And even democracies may be at danger because the government may be empowered in ways we are not fully aware of, which is the scary part.
We then spoke about the different perspective Chinese citizens will have on the West as opposed
for
to
a
the
lot
West
of Chinese
China.
People, if they see there is a generally hostile Western force trying to sabotage China's right, then their mindset would be conditioned to support whatever the Chinese government doing so far as they cite that as a reason. So if you are a Chinese, would you believe now the West is more hostile towards China in general? I would say so, yeah, right? Would you believe CNN or BBC more than before? Probably no, it's much less, right? Because Chinese would start become suspicious towards the intention. Is CNN or BBC part of, you know, the China smear campaign? I mean, objectively, I don't know. But if you're a Chinese, would you be convinced by that? I would say it's not very difficult for them to convince, you know, people about that. You might be willing to fight against an authoritarian regime who suppresses your freedom. That's kind of a framework of understanding what censorship is. The government is censoring us and we are freedom fighters, so we fight them. Or it's like this: the government is censoring for the nation's good to prevent, you know, the internal and external enemies from sabotaging our national revival and regime stability and everything. And if you convince people that regime stability is a good thing, people are willing to support you, even at huge cost. It's like, I'm willing to sacrifice a little piece of my freedom in order to defend Mother China.
Finally, we spoke about the impacts on people.
Yeah, there are a lot of studies in terms of, say, you know, how exposure to online content would affect people, right? So earlier studies basically kind of measure, say, how many hours you spend online and then measure your political orientation or political attitudes. Basically, people find that overall, the more you expose to online information, the more you're a little bit more critical towards the Chinese government. But the things can be tricky because, I mean, when you do the study might matter, right? My research is qualitative, but I find people might say nationalists who might become more critical towards foreign forces rather than the Chinese government under certain circumstances. They are also exposed to online. The more they expose online, not necessarily make them more critical towards the government, but less, right? And also, like, say, by the time 2009, 10, at that time, public intellectuals were very influential in China. And they were seen as positive figures there, right? Han Han and all those people. But from roughly 2011 onwards, the term public intellectual has become an increasingly negative term. And nowadays, if you say yourself, you know, say you are a public intellectual, you probably won't get a lot of applause. It's more like, you know, criticism more today, right? It's a more polarized online sphere now. So frankly speaking, I'm really not sure in terms of the implications. My overall argument is that one, internet used to open a more pluralized space for all sorts of expression, and people were competing with each other in terms of expressing themselves. Now, things are a little bit different because one, the state censorship capacity has increased. The state's kind of information management capacity in general has increased. Much less critical voices there in the first place. Second of all, critical voices like public intellectuals are either silenced or become like the target of state and more so public attack. So so it's like, would exposure to the internet now produce a different type of citizens? I've been involved in a work which is under review right now, so I can't talk too much about it, but it's suggesting that exposing to online information, especially social media information, would make people more active kind of complaining against local government. Is that good for the regime in total? Maybe, because it's like disciplining local governments. And even if it's like, you know, helping the central government in that regard, if they are not really kind of targeting the central government. We have to note that in China, there are certain realms of permissible protests. So certain types of permissible. It's like in China, there are different ways of participate. So it's wrong to assume that there's no way to participate in politics in China. That's wrong, right? You can become a party member. It's pretty easy. It's a mass party, frankly speaking, with like over 90 million people. So if you are politically ambitious, you can join the party. Two, there are limited like channels of state-sanctioned participation. There are elections, believe it or not. Whether that's meaningful or not, that's a different story, but there are elections. And there are letters of visit system. So if you have complaints, you can voice. In the past, you write a letter to the letter visits bureau, or you know, pay a visit to the letters of visits bureau. You can escalate that if you want. And nowadays, there are a lot of those government platforms that have interactional channel with people. So you can submit something to a mayor's box. And believe me, that the response rate sometimes can be very high. It's like, you know, I've observed a number of them, the variation. There's huge variation in terms of response rate. It can be as low as like 20, 30%, but it can be as high as 90. Within a number of days, the government responds to you, either promise a solution or say, we'll look into that at least. You can find occasionally, like say, rightful resistance. It's like you have rightful calls and you stage a demonstration or sit-in. The government try to demobilize that, but they're not going to put everybody in jail. And sometimes they would accommodate your request. They listen to you, send somebody to listen to you and try to come up with a solution. And sometimes, like, you probably have heard about the nail houses there, right? So it's like you refuse to remove for real estate, industrial or public projects. You can hear a lot of stories about people get the compensation they want. It's like you stage a small protest, you get what you want. So that kind of thing you can see. But there are certain types of saying that's prohibited. So it's impossible. If you want to organize say opposition party, you can't do that, right? Simply that you can't do that. Most people probably won't do that. If you want to start a human rights civic organization, it's trickier. Most of the time you get a no, but in some cases you might have a slim chance. Is the internet empowering certain type of activities or behavior of the citizens more than others? I think so. There are a number of, say, collective walks organized, somewhat organized by the internet, protesting chemical plants being built close to cities like the Kunming one, for instance. Citizens just send out messages online or via mobile phone and say, we're going to have a collective walk. They don't say we have a demonstration because the government doesn't want that. And they don't want some form organization to come into being as well. So that's why internet provides a little bit more convenience for people to organize that type of protest. And people just show up at the same time, kind of demonstrating, holding banners and doing all sorts of things. And they get their kind of wishes fulfilled by the government. This government make concessions, sometimes full concessions, sometimes partial concessions. There are sometimes more harsh crackdowns, but at least citizens get something. But is the internet effect, if you kind of try to organize that, you get a little bit more support. And if you are a taxi driver, you try to organize something, you have fellow taxi drivers to mobilize. Internet can be helpful in that regard, right? You can do that. If the enterprises owe you money, if you're protesting against pollution, all those kind of things are in a gray area. You get some leeway. But think about the Jasmine Revolution back in 2011, around that time. I mentioned that in my book. You have that very famous picture showing the demonstration on Guangfujing Street. In the picture, you see a handful, literally a handful of protesters, thousands of bystanders, and hundreds of policemen and reporters. They're not in the picture, but they are there. So if you're mobilizing for that type of thing, I don't think that's going to succeed. So in that regard, the picture was very telling. A few, because they were mobilizing widely online. It's like online mobilization was heated. But when people are going on streets, literally a handful of people showed up in Beijing. That might be the state is suppressing them effectively. That might be their cause is not generating a resonance among the public. But in general, I think also it's because any democratic movement, separatist movement that's especially aiming at overthrowing the regime is not quite popular. I don't think that the Chinese people are inherently all there for censorship. What I'm saying is that there are certain reasons make them more acceptable towards censorship. Okay, sometimes for personal reasons, right? As a caring parent, you don't want your kids to get exposed to certain type of content. I think that similar concern happens everywhere, right? And also for certain types of justified reasons. I mean, the Chinese government also bans information that kind of stirs up terrorism, for instance, right? You can't say that's not justified. There are a lot of political motivations. A lot of people don't like that, but they can tolerate that because of other reasons. Or there are some people, smaller section of the people would say, yes, that's justified in a bigger geopolitical environment, right? China is embedded right now. To some people, the Chinese Communist Party is a necessary evil. So it's not good, it's not ideal, but at the same time, it's better than, you know, what the West or those democratic activists is the kind of defamation of the Western forces, Western governments, Western media, Western society, or activists' defamation done by the government partially. Is there a reason why people kind of, you know, think in that way? Not because of the government. I think so as well. Because indeed, there are a lot of things that's beyond the Chinese government. And that's something to bear in mind. President Trump really helped China in that regard. President Biden isn't really reversing the course too much, considering, frankly speaking, US-China policy has been relatively consistent across the Trump-Biden transition, relatively constant. China, at least Chinese people, for them to reverse the perception of the geopolitical environment would need much more to be done there. It's not simply say, like, you know, the former Secretary of the State say, we differentiate the Chinese party from the people. Chinese people are not convinced. COVID really doesn't add too much to the whole thing. It makes things worse, makes the Chinese people in general more supportive of the Chinese government, adds to the legitimacy. COVID allowed the Chinese government to showcase its capacity. Outbreak in Wuhan, not lockdown of the entire city, national mobilization to support Wuhan, getting the COVID under control very rapidly. Considering the kind of the nature of the outbreak, it's like nobody knows what it is like. Right? We're not taking into the conspiracy theory of something being developed in the lab. I don't know about that part. I don't personally, I don't believe in that. But it's like if there's an unknown virus breaking out in a place, people know very little about it, and the government take very kind of forceful and, you know, effective measure trying to counter that in such a way. To a lot of people, that's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive, especially when compared to, like, say, the United States. You are alerted much earlier, right? You take no action, and the cases spread so crazy there, so many more deaths, right? And it's like, you know, the comparison makes a lot of Chinese really, first of all, very proud. Second of all, it's like they start to realize, first of all, the party is able to get things done. Second of all, they believe that the party is doing something for the people, for the good of the people. It's like saving people's life is the uttermost important thing. They're willing to sacrifice the economy. It's like all different sorts of rumors spreading there. It's like, no, the virus is actually developed in the US lab and spreads to Wuhan because of the military kind of, you know, sports game. And there are evidence of the virus being found elsewhere long before Wuhan and all those kind of information. Some of them are actually backed by some studies, but a lot of that was really just misinformation, conspiracy theory, and all those kind of things. Is the state behind that? I don't know, because what I see is most of those agencies are like we media or me media accounts there. So that's a tricky part. I'm working on something in terms of how deep the Chinese government might be involved in we media and me media. Is the Chinese government doing that? I don't know. We have some preliminary studies suggest that the government does work with we media on certain agenda, but not like that kind of agenda. They are not really intentionally spreading misinformation or conspiracy theory based on the information we have right now, but it's very limited information. I don't know. It's also about local government. So we don't really know whether that's part of the national or state campaign. But it's kind of, you know, that works to the government. Essentially, one of my my book's argument is really about the societal forces are really kind of working to the advantage to the state, not necessarily hand in hand with the government. But the government do have the motive and capacity to co-opt such forces. Nobody is for sure kind of is sure that things will get under control. But when President Xi Jinping comes out and says that, I'm going to take care of this. I assume full responsibility for this. That's not his literal words, but interpretation. That's pretty impressive in retrospect, right? It's like, look, the president was willing to take the risk and he was able to deliver it. That's more effective than any propaganda, frankly speaking.
So that brings us to the end of the discussion. Thank you so much to Zhongbin Han for all his help on this podcast. It was such a pleasure to talk to you, and I really hope everyone else has learned as much as I did from listening to you speak. If you'd like to learn more about this, please check out Professor Han's book, Contesting Cyberspace in China, Online Expression and Authoritarianism Resilience, which is a brilliant insight into the world of internet censorship in Chinese cyberspace. And if you haven't already done so, please check out Zealand's podcast on the Oxford website, oxford.org, where there's lots of other information, as well as another podcast on this topic by him. This has been Jemima Sinclair for Oxford Society for International Development. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed.